again, everyone. This is Alice Worsley welcoming you along to Planet FM this Wednesday and looking forward to your company, as always, for the next half hour. Got a very special guest we're going to be talking to in just a moment. A New Zealand nurse who has seen a tour of duty in a number of war-torn areas, including recently Iraq, but she's written a book about her time in Darfur. Now, I'm sure some of you remember the name Darfur bandied around by a lot of Hollywood celebrities these days who talk about Don't Forget Darfur. Well, Lisa Blaker has written a book called Heart of Darfur, and we'll talk to her in just a moment about that very, very special book. And then just after a little bit of music, we'll be with Doris Mosedale from Dimmicks, who's going to update us on some really good reads out in all good bookstores right now. But we're catching up today with Lisa Blaker, who's a Kiwi nurse, who, of course, has been a nurse here in New Zealand, but somehow got the call to give it a go overseas in places most of us just couldn't even countenance going to. And she joins me on the line right now. Hello to you.
Hi, Alice.
Now, can we do a little bit of a background on you? First of all, Lisa, as a nurse. Now, how far back do we go? Well, you don't have to say, 50 years ago or anything like that, but you've obviously been a nurse since you left school.
I have, so that's, 16 years.
16 years ago. And up until whatever time, you were just practicing as a nurse in the New Zealand area.
That's right. I've spent most of my career working here in Auckland.
Right. Mm. So when did you get that call, or whatever you would like to say it is, to try something a little bit different and be a nurse in a war-torn country?
I think I got the urge or the tickle quite early on when I first qualified as a nurse. Believe it or not, there was no work in New Zealand. So I waited for 6 months, was unemployed, and ended off heading off to South Africa, actually.
Right.
And started talking to and meeting people who had all sorts of exotic experiences around Africa. And that first started a little germ of an idea that probably took another 10 years before I got the courage up to give it a go myself.
So how did that... So then you came back to New Zealand, and hopefully by then there were a few vacancies for nurses. Now, of course, you could be working 24/7, couldn't you?
Absolutely.
There's such a shortage. It's bizarre how it all comes around again quite differently. So when, after that 10 years, did the chance come to do something a little bit different?
2002,
yeah.
I joined Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, and headed off to Sri Lanka with them.
Now, did they give you the call, or did you read about it on the internet, or how did you know about this group and that you wanted to be part of them?
I had actually met a girl on a boat on my way to Zanzibar, which sounds very exotic, but I was busy being seasick over the edge of the boat. And in between bouts, got chatting to a girl who was standing outside who had been working for MSF in South Sudan. And I remember watching her as she talked, and she looked so passionate and motivated and excited by what she was doing. And I remember looking at her thinking, I want to be like you when I grow up. So that was the first I'd heard of them.
Right.
Mm.
And then somehow it all fell into place that it triggered something in you that you wanted to go and be in Darfur?
I started off with MSF in Sri Lanka, and it slowly doors opened and led me on to other places. But I went to Darfur in 2005. A friend of mine was working in Darfur, actually, knew that I was feeling restless here in Auckland,
and
phoned and said, get yourself over here, we need you.
So that's what you did?
That's what I did. 6 weeks later, I was there.
Now, that whole business of becoming part of a team of people who work right at the edge of life and death in deserts or war-torn areas or whatever, did you have a little bit of an assimilation time where you got used to what you were going to do and they sort of gave you a training session on what to expect? Was there that transition time between being a Kiwi nurse and a Darfur nurse?
Yes, there was. There was, and MSF always prepares its staff pretty well, and there's somebody to hold your hand in the beginning to show you the ropes. But as luck or good luck or bad luck would have it, the team that I was due to join had to be evacuated because of a government attack. So I was sort of thrown in at the deep end, really, with the evacuated team.
Right. So you didn't perhaps get that lovely little introductory course that most people would have got.
theoretical, sitting in the office reading lots of books and folders, but... But no, once we got out to the field, there was somebody with me to show me the ropes.
Okay. Well, let's just put on the map for the listeners, one, where Darfur is, and two, what And I know it's hard to describe something so political as Darfur, but one, where is it? And two, what's the problem?
Darfur is in Sudan, in North Africa, just below Egypt. It's hot, it's flat, it's dry, and it's an area, it's a province of Sudan. And the government of Sudan has been fighting the people of Darfur for the last 4 years, I think. And it's a war for power, control, as the government tries to assert its authority with what they consider unruly villages. And it's also a tribal war, fighting over land. There are many layers to it.
So how does it affect the everyday people who live there? What is the effect on their lives?
The people who live there are mostly farmers and their families, their children. Mum and dad go out to the fields every day. The children are put in the little shelter on the edge of the field, and they watch mum and dad, or they come out and help, or they play in the shade. So left to their own devices, that's what they do. But unfortunately, as the government steals the land, the people run. So most of my work involved driving around in the bush looking for these people who had fled their homes with barely more than the clothes that they were wearing. These people are living in fear and constantly on the move.
Right. So your job was to find them, but then what did you do with them then?
We had a wonderful team of local staff trained in basic health care. And the two of us, my friend Karen and I, would look for groups, find them in riverbeds or under trees, and we would stop the car, unload the back, open the back doors rather, and get out our metal trunks full of drugs and equipment and start looking at and treating the women and children.
So you were literally a mobile medical clinic, really, weren't you?
That's right.
You would find the people and treat them. What kind of illnesses and diseases were they presenting with when you found them?
Oh, a whole myriad of illnesses and diseases. Common ones related to water, diarrhea, vomiting, malnutrition, malaria, and quite a bit of pneumonia. The desert temperatures at night plummet and these people don't have blankets.
Right. So were you able to address that side of things too, or would another aid agency step in to provide the blankets and the food?
In our little corner of South Darfur, there was only us. So we treated the people we could, and we supplied them with what we could. And perhaps in the long run, we didn't, we perhaps only touched the tip of the iceberg, but we did what we could. At the same time, there were attacks happening around us, and it was pretty unsafe. So we did the best we could with what we had.
Right. And I can understand that it must have been frustrating at times, I guess, knowing that there was so much more needed to be done, but you were unable to, deliver everything that was required.
Yes, and these people needed very little in actual fact, paracetamol and a few other treatments. But when the soldiers came and pointed their guns and said, "You will leave now," well, they're government soldiers, and you have to do what they say. So we would have to turn our backs on the people and leave them.
Did you deal much with people who had been beaten, shot at, wounded as a result of their dealings with soldiers, as well as the everyday illnesses that perhaps pervade a region like that?
Unfortunately, yes. We MSF also runs a surgical program, a hospital, in one of the big towns, Muhajiriyah. So many of the victims of the fighting make their way to our hospital.
So you would be dealing with some quite traumatic things, I would imagine, as a nurse.
Yes, but I think being a New Zealand nurse and being a very practical person gave me a good grounding. And it's all, a lot of it is common sense. It's just doing the basics with a wonderful team of people.
Were the people trusting of you, and I suppose in some respects dealing with the people on who are running away from danger, a white face was probably a safer face than one of their own colour?
Yes, I'm not sure about that, but MSF is well respected, and because one of the first things we do in any new place is get to know the locals, we always knew that we would be looked after by them, because once you've treated all the women and children, you've pretty much touched everybody's family,
yes.
And so they'd be grateful, and they looked out for us.
Which is nice to know, too. Where were you based then? Did you have, like, a headquarters where you stayed at night and then radiated out during the day, or what?
Some days we did, but we also would a couple of days a week, just pack up the truck and drive out and then camp out in the bush or in makeshift shelters and stay out overnight in villages. Because distances are so great, of course, you could drive 6 hours to get to a village. So we would take sleeping bags with us. Mm.
How are your camping out skills?
Oh, fantastic. I'm a Kiwi girl.
Now, come on, tell us about the snakes. I believe there were a few of those around in the desert as well.
We had grass huts with string beds that were set probably a foot above the ground. And I'd wake up in the morning and could see the marks through the sand beneath my bed where snakes had gone during the night. But they never bothered me.
It must be, maybe it's a bit like, you know, mosquitoes are attracted to some people and not others. Maybe Kiwi blood is not to the likings of Darfurian snakes.
Perhaps so. But, yeah,
you must have got yourself, though, in situations at times where, did you ever feel that you were in danger yourself?
Yes, particularly in the beginning when the government attacks were happening more often and the government soldiers were very threatening and intimidating, and there were times when I wanted to say, oh, come on, don't be ridiculous, just let us get on with our work. But when you've got a man pointing a gun at you and he says, stop, you have to do what you're told.
Mm.
And it's actually quite frightening.
Mm. How long is a tour of duty, if you don't mind me calling it that, where you go into a place like Darfur? Because I would imagine burnout would be a major factor to consider. So you couldn't be doing it day in, day out, year in, year out. So did you have a specified amount of time that you went in for and then a relief team took over from you?
The MSF asks that you commit to between 6 and 12 months. So most people do 9 months, which is enough to get your head down and start achieving something, hopefully without breaking you.
Yes. Mm. And did you find, though, yourself that there were times that you thought, I don't know if I can cope anymore, I don't know if I can do this anymore?
Oh, Alice, so often, when there is so much that needed to be done, and we were such a small team. They say that Darfur is the size of France, and there was 9 of us.
Mm.
And it was hard. It was heartbreaking. But your choice is either turn your head away, stop looking, stop listening and go home, or pull up your sleeves and do the best you can with what you've got.
So Doctors Without Frontiers, as we would call it here, you could only put 9 people on the ground for the whole of that Darfur region.
For this was one project in one corner
one
of Darfur.
Right.
The security situation has deteriorated so much in the last year, or 2 years, I guess, that organizations are trying to put as few people as possible to reduce the risk to teams, so that if anything goes wrong, they can send in a helicopter and get you all out at once.
Right.
And in fact, Muhajiriyah was attacked 2 weeks ago on Tuesday, and the village was attacked, the hospital was evacuated, 45 people were killed, including 2 of our staff.
Oh, gosh.
So everybody has to be on their toes and ready to leave at a moment's notice.
And the great sadness about this is that while this political situation stays as it is, it's the innocent people who lose, don't they? Because less and less people are on the ground to help them, which means that, you know, their illnesses, their problems just don't get attended to.
It's madness, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It is. But what I've tried to do with my book, with telling my story, is not to let people become too overwhelmed by all of this sadness and you know, the almost apparent futility of it all, because there are small successes, and people want to learn how to help themselves. Mothers want to learn how to treat their own children, and, you know, we did manage to move forward a little bit, and, you know, if peace gets a chance in Darfur, the people would just blossom. They really would.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, we hear Darfur mentioned more. It seems to have become a cause célèbre in Hollywood.
Yeah.
And I'm not too sure why. Is it because it is such a forgotten part of the world? You know, while we all concentrate on Iraq and Iran, people forget about all the terrible things that are happening in Darfur. Is that why some of the Hollywood celebrities have grabbed it and keep promoting it?
I'm not sure why. Certainly for the people of Darfur, they're not interested in who's promoting their cause so long as somebody is.
Yeah.
And certainly George Clooney and his father, Nick Clooney, and Angelina Jolie have done a lot to raise the profile of Darfur. I guess you have to pick your battles, if you will. And for whatever reason, these three have decided that that this is a situation that needs to be drawn to the public's attention. It's perhaps just as valid in Burma or Iran, but hooray for the three of them.
Well, that's right, because it has made it a name that people will think about now, whereas before a lot of people might not have known. And it was like how the world turned its back, really, on Rwanda, with things that went on there. You know, there was so little outside help. You'd hate to see this kind of thing happening again, but maybe that's what Western worlds, because we feel so helpless, we think, what can I do to change that situation? A lot of people just deal with affairs to hand rather than something that they just feel powerless to do anything about.
And I understand that completely, particularly when you're looking at something as huge as Darfur. Where on earth do you start? But honestly, I think we measure ourselves by our humanity and how we treat other people, how we look after our elderly, how we look after our children. And for me, I want to use the skills and gifts that I have to help other people.
Mm.
And so I actually go to these countries. But here in New Zealand, supporting Amnesty or supporting Oxfam or Save the Children, New Zealanders are good at doing their little bit where they can. And
So Amnesty, as you say, I know that that's got an interesting website and there's things people can do with petitions and things, but for practical on-the-ground assistance with the drilling of wells, you know, for water, that kind of thing, Oxfam, Save the Children would be two good organisations people could perhaps look at?
They would be fantastic organisations to look at. My reason for wanting to support Amnesty is all of our hard work in the sun, 50-degree heat, kneeling in the sand, all of it comes to nothing if the war carries on.
Mm.
And Amnesty's trying to do something to put huge pressure on the government of Sudan to stop the war. So perhaps we need to start at two ends. We need to put pressure on the governments, but we also need to support the people who are on the ground.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And you must have, and your book, of course, is all about the incredible experiences you had.
Mm-hmm.
Is there one that you can just share with us today, perhaps one, not necessarily a defining moment, but a moment that you had in Darfur that you thought, I'll never forget this, that, you know, this was just something that was literally seared, like the desert heat, into your memory and your heart?
Mm. Gosh, so many, Alice.
Yeah.
One that always springs to mind was one of my first big clinics, where we drove north to an area that had just been attacked. We didn't know what the situation was of the people who were there. We didn't know what we'd find, but there was no one else going. There was no Red Cross or United Nations. There was just us. So we turned up in the village, prepared to do whatever needed to be done, and there was nobody there. So we drove up to the clinic overlooking the lake, and we waited and we waited. And sure enough, people had seen our vehicles pass through the village and they started to come out of their houses. And within no time, there were hundreds of people, 300, 400, 500, 600 people, all needing to be seen, all needing to be treated for malaria.
Mm.
We had about 90% of our patients had malaria, cerebral malaria, which of course kills very quickly.
Oh, yes.
And again, instead of giving in to the hopelessness and the futility, I'm one nurse, what on earth am I going to do for 600 people? I had my interpreters who took me by the shoulders and said, right, Lisa, here you start, one by one. And they sat me down and we started seeing patients one by one. And we worked probably until 6-7 o'clock that evening.
Mm. On your knees.
One. And for what it's worth, we made a difference to the ones that we touched.
Yeah.
And it wasn't all of them, but we did the best we could. But pretty scary when you know that the government soldiers are watching you and they're armed to the teeth and they can do what they want, when they want, to whom they want.
So would you, if somebody rang you, and I know you've been you know, in Iraq since then, and now you're back nursing here in New Zealand, if there was one night at 10 o'clock at night a phone call from someone from MSF who said, we'd love you to come back, would you consider it?
Yes, I would, but I think my heart is still a little bit too fragile after Darfur. I think it needs a little bit more healing time.
And I would imagine it would make a huge impression on the heart as well as every other sense too, wouldn't it? And it would be, you would feel quite fragile about it. Well, you've written about it absolutely beautifully.
Thank you.
And I sincerely hope that people all over New Zealand are going to buy this book, read it, be touched by it, and, you know, in some small way say, hey, look, I want to try and make a little bit of difference, either with a, you know, a donation to Oxfam, Save the Children, or doing something with Amnesty International, just so that we all feel we've done our little bit as well.
I hope so, and I hope that they get something out of this book, not just feelings of guilt or sadness, but that they get some encouragement and hope from it as well.
Well, I'm sure that they will. It's absolutely superb, and I thank you for your time today, Lisa. All the very, very best for the future, and I hope our paths will cross again sometime in the not-too-distant future.
I hope so. Thank you so much, Alice.
Thanks for your time.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that's Lisa Blaker. That's her name, and her book is called Heart of Darfur, and it's about hope and humanity in the world's worst war zone. It's been described by Peter Harvey as a very powerful and human story of one of the great tragedies of recent years, published by Hodder and Stoughton. It's in all good bookstores right now, and it is well worth getting hold of.